Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you tonight to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas for another in our Art Talk series that we are delighted to co-present with our friends and colleagues at the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery, hosted by our friend Robert Enright, and tonight delighted to welcome Rebecca Belmore to Perimeter Institute. Just a little to give you a little bit of an idea of how tonight will unfold. Rebecca will do her presentation, followed immediately by Robert and Rebecca having our traditional discussion on the stage. And after that, the informal part of the evening where we invite you up to the fourth floor of the Black Hole Bistro for something to drink and to continue chatting informally with Robert and Rebecca if you'd like to join us. You, of course, find the Black Hole Bistro via the elevator on this side of the building or the staircase over on that side over there. Many of you will be very familiar with Alf Boguski, director of the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery. Since his arrival at KWAG 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 4 years ago, along with curator Alan McKay. Wonderful, wonderful things have happened at KWAG. The pair of them have done a magnificent job with that gallery, and it is a tremendous pleasure for us to collaborate with the two of them. And it's my pleasure to welcome Alf to the stage. Please welcome Alf Boguski.
Thank you. That works there, I guess, about that level. You can hear me. Three things. First, I just want to say something about our partnership with the Perimeter. Then a small commercial, and then it will be my pleasure to introduce Robert Enright, who will lead us through the evening and our wonderful encounter with Rebecca Belmore. We're really proud of the partnership with the Perimeter Institute. And here we have an institute dedicated to theoretical physics. It's a visionary institution which is going to do things, I'm sure, which will affect the world at large. It also has contributed a tremendous cultural program to this community, and it's really exceptional opportunity to collaborate with them. I mean, this is really an exciting place, an exciting place of ideas, an exciting place of even contrasts and conversations. And it really is happening in a community that has some quite extraordinary things happening throughout it and quite extraordinary potential. I'm quite convinced this is the axis upon which the world is turning these days. I think you should believe that. We feel the same intense pride and good fortune at the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery, and I certainly invite you to peruse the newsletters that have been put into your hand. And if you haven't visited the gallery lately, please do so. And if you enjoy the experience, which I'm sure you will, visit our website as well, which is all well detailed in there. The current show of Variations on the Picturesque, which runs to mid-March, is really something we're very proud of and you must see. And we look forward to seeing you there. The business at hand, Robert Enright. I'm going to quote here, Robert Enright is one of the country's most eloquent, incisive, and prolific thinkers on contemporary culture. His thoughtful and emphatic writing on the visual arts has, over the past 20 years, made his voice among the most respected and recognized in this field. He spent 25 years as an art critic for the CBC, and he still regularly contributes to the Globe and Mail and international art magazines like Art News, Modern Painters, and Art Review. He's published widely. Treatises like Eric Fischel, 1970 to 2000, and contributed to many books on artists, including Tony Tascona, Resonance, and Don Reichert, A Life in Work. He also founded Border Crossings, which, if you don't have a subscription to Border Crossings, you're culturally deprived, and you must do so immediately, because it is one of the most interesting and widely eclectic assemblies of excellent critical writing on the visual arts and other related concerns. Journalist Robert Fulford commented in an article for the National Post that the writers in Border Crossings accomplished better than most the critics' most difficult task, communicating art ideas to non-artists and artists alike, explaining what matters to the first group without boring or appalling the second. Enright conducts for Border Crossing some of the best published interviews in the country. He's a way of eliciting frankness from artists. And I think that's what he is about to do tonight. He says he tends to write about things that he's passionate about, and I know that he is passionate about the work of this particular artist, Robert Enright.
Thanks, John. Can I do this? Do you want me to use this mic? No. I like an emphatic no. That was a useful one. Thank you very much, Michael and Alf and Alan, for inviting me initially to be part of this series. I think I can say, since I know most lecture series in the country, that this is probably the most distinguished, not because I'm involved in it, but because of the artists that through the partnership between KWAG and the Perimeter Institute we've been able to invite. And it's going to get, it's going to be equally as good as it's been in the past. So I'm pleased about that. I'm reminded when Alf was talking about the magazine 25 years ago, around that time, Robert Croach, the distinguished Canadian writer, published a fabulous book, which has become, and you'll pardon the pun, a seminal book in Canadian literature called Seed Catalogue. And in it, he took the seed samples from catalogs from a 1913 Mackenzie's Briggs seed catalog and use them as the kind of poetic stepping off point for this wonderful vernacular book of poetry. But one of the things in the seed catalog which they used to sell in the prairies was brome grass, and the way they advertised it was, it flourishes under absolute neglect. It occurs to me that that may be a description of Canadian culture in lots of ways as well. So I'm thankful to Croach for his reminder that that horticulture and culture are close and difficult much of the time. I'm looking at this fabulous image of Rebecca's right here, and I'm kind of mesmerized by the red mummy. I'm particularly delighted to be here tonight to introduce an artist for whom I've had a long admiration. She's not old enough for it to be that long, but it's certainly significant. I have known or tried to pay attention to Rebecca's work for a long time. I think what's most astonishing about it, and I won't say a whole bunch about it because she's here and we'll have a chance to talk about it soon. I think what's always struck me about it is a quality that is unusual in performance art. Performance art is not an easy form because of its transactions with time and space, it can get into all kinds of problems. Rebecca has found a way, and I hope we can get inside her head to find out how she does it, but to make performance both exacting and almost voluptuously passionate in the performance. I can't think of a more intense performer. And seeing a Rebecca Belmore performance is really quite remarkable for its visceral quality. And this is what I particularly admire about it, for its poetic quality, for the way that it somehow focuses something essential in the act of ritualizing our actions and our movement as human beings. I'm not sure how she does it, but you can certainly, it's like what you like in painting. You don't quite know why, you just know what you like. And what I do know is that I'm tremendously moved by the performances of Rebecca Belmore, those I've seen in person and those I've seen through video and other ways of now recording them. So please join me in welcoming to this distinguished lecture series a distinguished Canadian artist, Rebecca Belmore.
Thank you. I'm a little tired, but I'll do my best. Damn chalk. Wake up. Okay, I'm just going to try to keep myself to 45 minutes. So someone give me a heads up and let me figure out how to use this thing again. Oops. Actually, delete that there. Okay. It looks really weird from this angle. I just this piece is called White Thread, and Robert referred to it as the Red Mummy, but I think of it as a self-portrait. It's not me, but the person wrapped up. And this is a part of a series of works that I did in, I believe, in 2002. And this is another piece. This goes with that one. This is called Bloodless. And these are inkjet digital prints on watercolor paper, and they're quite large. The scale is about 40 inches by 50 inches, thereabouts. This is 41 inches by 41 inches. Then I continued with this kind of photography, and I work with my sister. The model in the images is my sister. So I do all kinds of strange things to her and torture her, like you're supposed to do to little sisters. There's actually three images, which I don't have, but this is one of three. It's like a triptych, and this is an untitled series. And this is about, it's about 48 inches wide by 60 high, I think, something like that. Technology frightens me. I want to show you this image. Let's see. Okay. In 1987, I made this work. Oh, shoot. Okay, there. I made this work, which is titled "Rising to the Occasion," and in on July 16th, 1987, Prince Andrew and his new bride, Fergie, came to Thunder Bay, and they were doing their honeymoon tour of Canada at that time. So they flew into Thunder Bay, and they were taken outside the city and somewhere up the highway, the Trans-Canada, and they were put into a birch bark canoe. And then they were paddled down river towards the Lake Superior. And they disembarked at the reconstructed historic trading fort, the fur trading fort, Old Fort William, where they were met, and there was all this festivity to welcome the royal family as they replayed their role in Canadian history. So I think I was really taken with this whole idea of, well, if they're going to jump into a birch bark canoe, I mean, how can I try to, you know, participate and celebrate that history as well, in my own way? So I made this dress called Rising to the Occasion. And there's another image here. So basically, in 1987, I had just left art school, the Ontario College of Art, and I had returned to Thunder Bay to my home where most of my family lives. And I remember I rented a studio for like $150, and I was pretty broke, but I was living on the remains of my student loan because I quit school. So I decided to get to work. And so this dress basically is made of materials from the Salvation Army. These are like bathrobes and some big skirt with some embroidery that I found in the Salvation Army. And then I just fashioned the back of it, which is a beaver house, with trinkets, like trade goods, shiny objects to catch my eye, my Indian eye. And there's like crumpled up images of the royal family, there's birch bark, there's all kinds of things trapped in this beaver dam. So essentially, it's basically my interpretation or my creation of a Victorian ball gown meets the beaver dam. Or the damn beaver, I don't know. And I thought it was appropriate because, you know, they were at this fur trading fort, which is, you know, of course, many beaver were killed to create this whole industry and promote the wealth. I have this other work. I'll show you this image first, though. This is a lovely Thunder Bay. It's the sleeping giant out there somewhere in the water. This work is titled in Anishinaabe, which is the language of my people, the Ojibwe people. And it's titled Ayumiya Watch Omamamwan. I have a hard time saying it. It's a mouthful. But it translates into speaking to their mother. And so in this was taken in 1992. But in 1991, I was invited to the Banff Center to participate in an exhibition at the Walter Phillips Gallery. So I went there as part of a residency. And I had this object built by a couple of wonderful technicians there, Mimo and Bob. And basically, it's plywood rings. And inside, I don't have a picture of the inside, but inside it's a mahogany laminate. And it has the mechanism from a metal loudhailer kind of put into the mouth. And I created this work because I was trying to make a work that responded to the Oka crisis. The Oka crisis is, of course, when the Mohawks were fighting with the Canadian Army for, I believe it was 78 days. There was a standoff between the Mohawk nation of Gunasatage and the Canadian military. And it was all over a land dispute, which, of course, was the fact that the town of Oka wanted to expand their golf course another 9 holes. So I thought about, that was in 1990 when the Oka crisis happened. So at that time, I was in Thunder Bay. And I just recall all the, you know, all the media coverage on the situation. I recall how other First Nations communities and non-First Nations people rallied to support the Mohawk fight by blockading railroads, by leafleting on highways, and by blocking roads, you know, as a way of supporting the protest of this land, their land being, you know, taken away, or the threat of it, at least. So at that time, I also recall how racism reared its ugly head again. And I was, you know, just at art school, and I thought, well, you know, life is good. I'm going to have a good career, and it's going to be, you know, I'm going to have a good time. I just want to do my work. But then I realized during that crisis, you know, as an individual walking around in my city, I was subject to all kinds of racist remarks. And so it was kind of a slap in the face, you know. It's like, okay, you better, you know, stand up straight and do something and fight back in some way. So this work comes out of that kind of thinking or that experience. Because what I wanted to do is I wanted to make an object that would somehow examine this idea of protest, and specifically First Nations protest. So I had this megaphone, which, you know, I blew it up out of proportion. And in the summer of 1992, I took it across Canada to First Nations communities, both kind of rural, reservation, and urban. And basically, it's set up in particular sites. We began on the steps of Parliament Hill. And that was during the time of the Constitution talks in 92. And it was funny because I was sitting with them, we were sitting around, hanging out on the stairs of the Parliament, and I recall seeing a gentleman walking up, you know, that big alley towards the front doors, and he had all these men in dark suits and sunglasses kind of flanking him. And as he came closer, I realized he was wearing a really strange pale green suit. Not quite pistachio or something like that. Anyways, I ran down the steps as he was, you know, coming up, and I cut him off. The guys kind of tried to cut me off, but I was too fast. So I grabbed his hand and patted his shoulder, and I said, "Would you like to speak to our mother?" And he just looked at me, and he said, "No, I'm sorry. I'm late for a meeting." And that was then Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. So then, 5 minutes later, I see another gentleman come walking forward. And I did the same thing. I asked the same question. And it was Joe Clark. I said, "Would you like to speak to our mother?" So he said, "Sure." And then, so he went to the thing. And he said, "Mother Earth, we need you." Which I think that's it. People don't believe the story, but it's like I'm making up a bad joke. Then, to jump forward, so that was the early 90s. Now this is 2001, September 2001. This piece is called Wild, and basically it was six artists were invited to make site-specific works in the Grange House, which is the building, the historic home from where the AGO grew out of. So it's attached to the back. I don't know how many people have been there. It's kind of hidden. But basically, it's a historic house that's set up to be authentically, you know, a period piece. It's not the authentic original furniture, but it's, you know, of that time period. So I was invited to come to a meeting and check out the house and, you know, come up with a proposal. So immediately I saw this bed in the master's bedroom, and I thought, okay, that's where I want to be. So I redressed the bed, and basically it's a bedspread that I created that has, it's taffeta with human hair, and the canopy is also my creation, which has the beaver pelts. The house was, I think they began building the house in 1816, and it was completed in 1836 or something like that. I think I have my dates right. So my thinking was that, you know, as an Aboriginal woman, I thought, well, hopefully, but you never know, or maybe I'm the first Aboriginal woman to sleep in this bedroom. But I think we've been sleeping together for a long time, so I wasn't quite sure, but it was a very, you know, a very grand house for at that time. And so I was just wanting to insert myself into this, you know, into this history, to insert my presence in a very personal, very kind of visceral way. So in September, I hung around in Toronto. I was living in Vancouver at the time. I had just moved there. So I hung around for September in Toronto, and on Saturdays I would go take a rest. So I'd party Friday night, rest on Saturday. But I didn't pose like to freeze myself or like I'm some kind of dummy or a mummy. But I just basically would lounge about, you know, I lay about and ignore people. You know, I might stare towards the doorway, and it's that kind of space where it's railed so you can't come into the room. So I felt very much like a human exhibit in some kind of zoo situation. So there you go, Wild. Okay, so we're going to switch to video now. And This is where you have to be patient with my, with me and my, I'm going to disappear once in a while, so just entertain yourself. generally my performances can be anywhere from, you know, a minute to, a minute to 45 minutes. They're usually not longer than that. I tend to work, I'm comfortable like in a 20-25 minute range because I think people have short attention spans, so I try to, you know, keep people's attention. So in 1991, I was invited to participate in the Havana Biennale in Havana, Cuba. And the site where I'm performing is in this beautiful old colonial castle, which is on the harbor in Havana. And it was a really great space because the walls are, stone walls were really thick. It had a moat and a drawbridge, it was that kind of castle. And in the center, there was a stairwell, which was four landings. And it was open to the sky. So if you were to stand on the bottom, you could look up and see the beautiful sky. Which was a really neat experience because if you think of the history of that, you know, I was thinking about the history of that building, that place. And so I made this work, which is called Creation or Death, We Will Win, because, you know, of course, in Cuba, there are slogans around that say revolution or death, we will win. So creation or death, we will win. And I was basically in Cuba for about 7 days. I think I arrived on a Wednesday, and on Saturday I had to come up with a performance piece. So this is what I created. And it's about 11 minutes long, so I'm going to just play it and fast forward so that you can just see what it looks like. I hope it doesn't make you dizzy when I speed up, but just be careful. Sorry. Thank you. someday I'll edit this all and it'll be all neat and tidy. So essentially, this is basically a piece where I just put a bucket of sand on each landing, and I'm bound at my ankles, my wrists, and my mouth with a red rope, a beautiful little red rope. And I just move the sand up the staircase, creating a line of sand. What you kind of see it in the background in this image is what you see is what you don't see. You don't see it very well in the document, is because everyone has to use the staircase to get up. Because I was in a group show, and the show, the exhibition, the rest of the artists, three other artists, were in a space at the top in a room. And so everyone, there's like 250 people trying to get up the stairs. But I wouldn't let them because I was very aggressive. And someone tried to get past me, and I almost hit him. But it was just this idea of trying to think about the history of Cuba and the whole Spanish invasion. And I was thinking about, well, most likely, I mean, who built this castle? Most likely Indian slaves. And of course, in Cuba, the indigenous people no longer exist. So I was just thinking about that. And I like the contrast between the grain of sand, you know, like time and stone, time, history, and trying to put it together in a very short, you know, period of time, in a few days. And because Cuba is such a, you know, at that time, especially in the early 90s, they had very little. So art materials, I know I didn't even think of that. So I tried to keep it as simple and as simple as possible. See ya. Now, the next piece I'll show you is it's a work that I did on the internet. It was streamed through the internet. And it was projected into three or four other cities. So it was projected into, I did it at the the studio space that I used was at the Emily Carr School of Art and Design. And it was projected into an artist-run center, Grunt Gallery in Vancouver. And it was also projected into another artist space in Manchester, UK. And then also in Sydney, Australia, and then somewhere in China. I can't remember where. But my request was that the piece is called Tent City, and basically it was my attempt, or you know, my first attempt at using the internet to make work. So I thought, well, you know, I'm used to performing in front of people, and you know, I like that kind of relationship. So how do I take something so removed and make a performance that might make, you know, that I can feel good about and might make, you know, be of interest to others? So at that time, the work was created, I think, in 2003. And it was in the winter time. It was in November, late November. And at that time, the homeless people, were organizing themselves, and what they were doing is they were occupying, setting up tents in city parks. And so it became referred to in the media as Tent City. So what I did is I went down to, they had one camp right beside the Science Center, which is, you know, fairly developed, kind of touristic, and there's like bicycle paths and people jog and get healthy. But at the same time, it was really interesting because in contrast to that, you know, that dome, in the shadow of the dome with the SkyTrain passing by, the McDonald's right next door, these people set up their tents as a protest, to protest the issue of housing, affordable housing. Many of the people had, you know, part-time jobs. You know, some people didn't work. You know, so it's kind of diverse in terms of who was there. There's a lot of young people. And then what I asked is I went to the camp and I said, well, can I, you know, shoot your camp on video? And they said, well, sure, as long as we're not, you know, don't put the camera in my face. And so I went there when basically people, in the daytime when people were gone or if they're still sleeping or who knows what. Anyways, the camp was quiet. And basically I just panned, you know, the Tent City and around. You can see the beautiful skyline of Vancouver. You see the Science Center and then back to the tent. So it's like a long, slow pan. And I used that pre-taped video and took it to the studio at ECAD, and working with two technicians, one a musician and the other a video person, basically I performed in front of a blue screen, and one technician mixed the pre-tape with my live action, and the other person was a musician and he made a live soundscape for the piece. So the piece is called Tent City. It had to be specifically a half hour long. So it's a half hour long, but I'm just going to show you like a few minutes of it. Thank you. So what you don't, if I showed you the whole thing, then you would get a better picture of it. But basically what I did is I set up a tent in the gallery space where the image was projected onto the wall. And I requested that they put all the equipment into the tent. And so then the image was projected out onto a wall, you know, facing the tent. And what I thought was interesting is, you know, the science dome thing there has like an exoskeleton. So it has all the, you know, the grid system to hold it together, hold it up on the exterior. And it's interesting because, you know, tents are made basically the same way. So I like the idea of using the dome tent. There's the Science Center dome there as well. The next piece I'll show you is not that one, is Well, that sucks. I have the wrong one. I have a part of it here. I'll show it to you here. I hope it works. Okay. This piece is from 2002. I'll explain it later. Look at it first. So often I arrive. My latest, you know, thing is to arrive with all my stuff. So, and a lot of times I like to clean the space where I'm going. So there's this whole section of trying to light these candles. And what happened is... Karen! Thank you. So this is whole part of ridding myself of stress. This was about 45 minutes long, and essentially it's, you know, the cleaning of the space, the yelling of the names, and the donning of the dress, and the removal of the dress, and then getting dressed myself back into my own clothes, and then the truck with the song. And this was performed at, this performance took place at the corner of Cordova and Gore Avenue, which is in the east side, downtown east side of Vancouver, of course, and that's where the, you know, the missing, the 65 plus women went missing. So the piece is about the missing women and the murder of those women. And so what you see on my arms are basically all the first names. A lot of them had, you know, very same names like Teresa, Elaine. So I just wrote the name once on my arm. And what was interesting also is that, you know, I had like an audience that was in the know, and then people who were wandering by might stop and look for a while, and some stayed, some took off. And while we were there, you know, a police car drove by behind me, behind the fence, up the alley, and across the street there was another telephone pole, and there were prostitutes working at the same time. The piece that I'm going to show you now is the video component of my installation in Venice called Fountain. And it's basically a, you know, like a 2.5 minutes thereabouts video. Jeez. Okay, I'll tell you later. essentially it would just play over and over again. And I projected it onto a water screen, which is something that I purchased. It actually is an existent apparatus, which is used mainly, I think, in like for rock concerts and events, maybe weddings, I don't know. But I used it in the Venice Biennale at some wedding. So I think, you know, basically the piece was shot in January 23rd in Vancouver, out at Iona Beach, which is a beach which is situated between the Squamish Nation, so this is a reservation, a reserve, and the airport. And Iona Beach is, at Iona Beach there is a water filtration plant, and there's a long kind of spit that goes out into the ocean, and that's where the waste from Vancouver is pumped out. So I'm in the water beside the sewage plant, and the water was extremely cold in, you know, January 23rd, and we did about 4 takes, the screen itself in Venice was about 13 feet wide by 9 feet high, and you'll see an image of it on this tape. It was very difficult to document because it was just complex, and so I don't have great documentation of the work when it's up and running, but you'll get an idea of what it looked like. So I'm going to show you now like a tape, which is basically me in Venice on my opening day. So the opening and the, you know, of the my exhibit. And the sound is a bit weird, so bear with it. Please.
Thank you, Mario.
Perfect.
You're beautiful.
The whole art world class here. It's a great stage for an artist to show. A great place for an artist to show. All the little trailers and things from here would be 10,000 people in the next 3 days.
Very fashionable. Lots of cell phones. Very deep. Very flamboyant. Amazing. So that's the Canadian Pavilion. That's behind the waterfall looking through at the audience. is Jan
An exhibition Bailey. Of this magnitude She'll requires intense organization. And I would like to thank everyone, both here in Venice, helping us out, and many others back in Canada. I would especially like to thank the staffs of the Belkin Art Gallery, the University of British Columbia, and the Kamloops Art Gallery. We have had remarkable friends across Canada who have assisted us with this exhibition and had the vision to support this project financially. I hope you will take a moment to say thank you to each of them. We have listed all their names both in the pavilion and in our very handsome publication. It is now my pleasure to introduce my co-commissioner, a colleague I respect and admire, and who has been amazing to work with this year, Scott Watson.
Thank you, Jan. I'd like to add my thank you remark. When Jan and I and Rebecca took this on, we went across Canada asking for advice and support, and we received it in overwhelming abundance. So many of you here today who support this project, I want to thank you very, very much. It made me very proud to be a Canadian to realize how many people would get behind the presentation of Rebecca Belmore at the Venice Biennale. I'll just say a few words about the work. Rebecca is here, and I feel very embarrassed speaking about an artist's work in front of them, trying to mediate their work, especially this work in this circumstance, in this place. But I want to thank Rebecca, first of all, for taking this on. Of course, it's a great honor and a great opportunity to represent a country at the Venice Biennale. But as you might notice, the instrument we're dealing with in the pavilion is an unusual instrument. And I think that Rebecca had a lot of guts to take it on. It's a hard one to work with. And she's produced a magnificent work in hard circumstances. Just to say a few words about the work, Rebecca's work, appeals to me and appeals to her public because of its power, its emotional power and its intellectual rigor and a simplicity that unfolds into a complexity. The work you are about to see or have seen deals with the traditional four elements of the cosmos, air, earth, fire, and water, and depicts the transformation of water into blood. The work, in a way, at least to me, is a monumental self-portrait. And it mixes together melancholy, a sense of anger and recrimination, but also provides the elements of energy for a new beginning. And I hope that Rebecca's work is taken to heart. I think there's a very strong message in it. And on that note, I'll hand over to you.
Canada has participated in the Venice Biennale since 1952, and 58 remarkable artists have represented Canada. Rebecca Belmore is the first Aboriginal woman artist to be here in Venice. And I would like to echo Scott's remarks about the strength and power and poetry of this piece. Rebecca has been remarkable to work with. Her diligence and attention to every aspect of this project has been monumental. And it's demonstrated, of course, in the work that you've either seen or will see shortly. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege and pleasure to introduce Rebecca Belmore. Welcome everyone and thank all of you, every one of you who helped bring me here. So, and everyone who worked, I would like to thank my preparators, Mimo and Vaughn, my husband Oswaldo, my new friend Ian. What is his surname? I just met him. So. Anyway, thank you. Thank you very much. And I would like to thank Scott Watson and Jan Bailey. They were fabulous to work with. And I think that I hope that you enjoy the piece. And I guess I just want to say, I want to make a comment here. Like, this, I love this podium. Normally I hate podiums. But if you just look at this, I mean, this is my country. We don't have a great big ego, I don't think. So that's a good thing. Very high. It's very special.
It's a little.
And then, so again, just thank you.
I don't know if there's images on here of the piece from the front. Sorry. I don't think there might be.
Losing it up behind the wall.
Anyway, that's enough. Thank you. So we'll move on to the next phase of the show. Okay.
I'm gonna see. That's my notebook. Gee. So when Scott Watson talks about melancholy and anger, are those in his description of the piece, are those two of the things that have driven not just this work, but other work too?
I don't know if it's anger. Maybe it's rage.
Nice distinction. So,
and I don't know if that's melancholy. Maybe it's, I don't know. I guess it's difficult for me to comment on what you're, I don't know what you're trying to get me to say.
No. It's so much, I mean, I'm fascinated by work that mm-hmm. comes out of some kind of intense relationship with a power structure of one kind or another.
Uh-huh.
So that, and there's ways to react to it. I mean, rage is one. Your work is deeply political.
Yes.
And I don't know, so I guess I'm asking, what are the possible reactions to a context in which you find yourself that you not only resist it, mm-hmm. but resist it in a kind of profound way, which might lead to rage.
I think that's, I like the word that you've just used there is resistance. And I see it, you know, not so much as anger and melancholy, but resistance in a very, I think, you know, it's visceral, it's, you know, could be possibly dangerous, but at the same time, I'm totally in control.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not it looks out of control, but I'm totally in control. Because I think what I'm trying to do is, through the use of my body and the energy contained within this body, I try to bring life or bring, you know, an intensity to, you know, this whole act of trying to say something about something very specific or something, and also general themes. But often I think how I've used performance is to, you know, as a, what I love about it is it's a way to respond to an immediate situation and political situations or social situations.
Is the strategy to keep it as simple as you can in the presentation of it? Because critics from one end of the alphabet to the other, commented on the simplicity of the work as a kind of structural device. That's the strategy you use?
Definitely, because I think what I like to do is I use, you know, very immediate kind of materials that are everyday kind of materials, like rope or pail or soap or water. And what I think is, how I think I am effective in my choices is that immediately everyone can relate to the material. Therefore, hopefully, they're going to be interested and maybe have some kind of experience, you know, going along with me and understand maybe, or think of, at least think about what it is that I'm, what they think I might be saying, you know, what am I trying to say.
And you don't rehearse, do you?
No.
So the event, the intensity of the event is generated out of the doing itself.
Yes. And I've come to, you know, over the years, I've come to think of my performance work as the making, you know, like the making of an artwork, much like a sculpture or an installation. So I think it's, you know, I've come to think of it as, and that's why I like to arrive with my tools and then just get down to it and get to work and make the piece.
It's interesting to work. I mean, the pieces, I don't know how you feel inside them, but the apprehension of them, they seem like they're very hard physically. You said dangerous at one point when talking about resistance, but I felt you might have been talking about the nature of the performance itself. Is it important that you are so physically involved in the performance?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think they're that arduous in terms of, they're not, I mean, it's work, but it's not, it's hard work, but it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm interested in is just trying to somehow, through this, you know, the strain of the making is to somehow, I guess, get people to think about how we are as human beings and all the danger and the, you know, all the horrible things that we do to each other. So I think, you know, it's more of a psychological danger than a physical danger.
It's interesting, of the 58 artists who had been at the Biennale, you were the first Aboriginal woman. There was, Edward Protras was there about maybe two or three Biennales before, and he'd been the first Aboriginal of any kind.
I was supposed to be there with him, but they axed me at the last minute.
In what capacity?
They just decided they didn't want me.
This is
terrible. This is terrible news.
This is news to me. This is, ladies and gentlemen, if it matters.
But it was, I think it was, you know, Gerald did approach me when, actually I'm revealing big secrets here.
Wow.
But Gerald did approach me and suggested the two of us, but I think then they later thought. And deservedly so, Edward deserved to be there on his own. And actually, in retrospect, I'm very happy that it happened the way it happened. Mm-hmm. Because I think then I got the space to myself. And at that time, I was much younger, so I maybe wasn't ready to do the job.
There's a real sense of drama. I've been thinking, as I look at the palette of the pieces, the earlier pieces you showed using your sister, in which red and white or pure colors are used in lots of ways, the sheeny blackness, and the beautiful shiny blackness of the hair, those just seem like very formal decisions. And if you were a painter, you'd be a kind of formalist in lots of ways.
Most likely. But at the same time, if you look at the Tent City piece, I see that piece as a very painterly kind of work because, you know, how the colors mix and move and mutate. And so I think, you know, but to be honest, yes, I am attracted to, you know, very basic colors. And often I use red and white to, you know, symbolize purity and blood, or it also can symbolize, you know, the Canadian flag as red, and it can symbolize our nation. So I think, you know, it's, you know, I made those choices. You know, they're very specific choices.
This isn't a purient question, but what were you wearing in the bed in the piece in Fiji? Were you?
Yeah.
Now see, that's really, now that's radical.
Well, yeah.
Not because to be naked is radical.
But
to inhabit that bed is, I mean, that's
And I think it's actually interesting because when people came to the room, you know, some people would, you know, they like the work. Friends would come and try to get me to speak to them. I totally ignore them. And then other people would be really pissed off. because I remember it was like two women came in, and they were like a family, probably like a mother-daughter, and they looked all around the room, and they marveled at all the objects, and they totally ignored me. It was really wonderful. Yeah. So in that sense, I think, you know, the subversive kind of situation that I was trying to create was, you know, was successful then.
Now, did you actually sleep? I mean, were you able to sleep, or were you conscious?
No, I was always awake and aware.
So you're returning, the gaze is going back to the audience, in a sense. I mean,
yes.
You're aware of what they're doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing them and looking at them. And
So how much is the work that you do about your gathering of power?
I don't know if it's about a gathering of power, but maybe it's just like focusing on power. And I think it's, you know, I think that, you know, as an individual, as an artist, as an Aboriginal woman, you know, I'm interested in trying to witness, address, and mark history, mm-hmm. current history, and particularly First Nations history. So I've done a lot of pieces about, I've done a few works about, for example, like the situation in Saskatoon where the police were taking the drunk Aboriginal men and dropping them off to freeze to death. So, you know, I think there's no lack of material out there for me to respond to anywhere mm-hmm. on this continent and perhaps all of the Americas.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Saskatoon case is only one, but it's particularly, I mean, it's a sort of a bad one because people knew about it and it kept going on and on. And then the police chief did the same thing that happened in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. tried to shut down the investigation very early on. Do you get, when you talk about rage as an Aboriginal person, mm-hmm. does it enrage you that this kind of thing continues, that it seems not to be diminishing, that the awareness seems not to be penetrating at levels that you'd like it to?
I guess on a daily basis, like, I try not to get too, you know, immersed in it, but I think it's these situations and the fact that I know, you know, the situation for First Nations people in this country is, you know, it's not a great... We're still not, you know, in a great place collectively. So I think, you know, I try to do my best to be a concerned, you know, individual, but at the same time to try to enjoy my own daily life. And so, you know, it's kind of a mix of, you know, I'm not angry every day is what I'm trying to say.
And so. The other thing that is of interest, obviously, is that, I mean, the reason I mentioned Edward before mm-hmm. is that even inside Aboriginal culture, the politics of gender and sexuality come up. So in some senses, you've got a double load that you've got to deal mm-hmm. with. It's one thing to be Aboriginal. It seems to me it must be another thing to be an Aboriginal woman. Does that play into the work in a conscious way?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think it's natural. You know, it's not... I do it because I am. So it's you know, it's pretty straightforward. There's no, you know, big thinking going on up here in terms of like, how am I going to represent Aboriginal women? I, by virtue of my existence, do represent. So, and through the work I can address, you know, from my authentic point of view and my authentic voice.
Mm-hmm. But Scott also talks about the intellectual rigor of your work, and I think mm-hmm. he's right, that the rigor is made manifest in the simplicity of it, but mm-hmm. it's also clearly you're making very conscious choices about how you enact the narrative you're telling. These
yes.
are very focused decisions you're making.
Yes, definitely.
And they're decisions that so the overall story you want to tell, is it episodic and adds up to something larger?
Well, I don't think it's episodic. I like that word, though.
It's a good word.
It's like a TV show.
That's what we make a Belmore bring to.
Episode
3, death.
yeah, too much death.
Too much.
But I think, I just think of it as, I see myself as just someone who, you know, we have X amount of time to make work as an artist, and then I just see myself as, you know, going through life doing what I do and, you know, taking a look around mm-hmm. to see what's going on, because I think that's, you know, it's something that, you know, we should all do. I think it's, you know, to really be conscious of what's happening in your place, mm-hmm. where you are.
Mm-hmm. So. Northrop Frye said that one way to guarantee that you self-colonize yourself, no matter where you come from, is if you ask the wrong, if you don't recognize where is here. He says the center is where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, where's the center for you then? Is it a psychic space or a physical space?
It's a psychic space. I think that, you know, in the early 90s, I did a lot of site-specific yeah. installation works. And, you know, basically I would just try to be in a place and find myself in that place so that I could articulate an idea that would be, you know, as honest as I could possibly be. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, you know, and I think that has a lot to do with my interest in the body of, you know, performance work that I've made is, you know, I'm very self-conscious and I'm totally into me. and I think, I mean that jokingly.
They were absurd.
I know. me. But I think, you know, it's, I just like to see myself as a witness. I think I'm starting to think of myself more like mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my role as an artist and as a Aboriginal woman artist, I think it's the best thing that I have to offer.
Mm-hmm. The Canadian poet A.M. Klein had a line where he says, only those who have memory will understand. And I wonder what the role of memory in the process of witnessing is for you.
I think memory is, you know, I often have used that word when I had to write about my stuff, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, as an Aboriginal person, as an Anishinaabe, and as Indians, you know, because we come from an oral history, mm-hmm. and because of the whole, you know, our colonial history, a lot of language has been lost, and I'm an example of that. I'm a non-speaker of my own language. And so I think that's how I became kind of interested or kind of fixated on this idea of memory. And a lot of, you know, performances are ephemeral, and I like the fact that they can be lost as well. So it's kind of like a weird, maybe that's where the sadness or the melancholy mm-hmm. comes in, mm-hmm. because I think it's, you know, maybe it's a longing, a longing for, you know, I wish we had a better memory mm-hmm. of our language, of our, you know, religion, et cetera, et cetera. Because I think, you know, lots, you know, it happens all over the world. You know, people mm-hmm. lose things. Culture, you know, peoples lose memories. So I think, you know. Yeah.
So there's the elegiac side of it. Where then does the nature of celebration come into the work? I mean, how is it also a process of some kind of emotional or psychic retrieval?
That's a good question. I don't know how to answer that one. I think, I don't know. I mean, it's the celebration, I guess celebration makes me nervous, but I think it's more about, you know, as an individual, at least, you know, I'm trying to do something, or I can say, well, I did something in response to. So I think that for me is trying to, especially when people, and especially Aboriginal people, when they come up to me and say, well, that was a really great what you did, because I felt something, you know. I can make people cry, which is really great in a performance. That's how sad they can be. Mm-hmm. because, for example, I'll give you an example, like the piece in downtown Vancouver. A friend of mine was in the audience, and I, you know, I don't see her that often, maybe a few times a year I run into her. But she mentioned months before that her sister was one of the women who was missing. And so she came to the performance piece And she said, after, she said, I have to go home because I'm going to start crying, but just thank you, I want to thank you. And she said, it's too bad that you didn't call out my sister's name, because she wasn't on the list. Mm-hmm. So, and I had neglected to think about and retrieve that, you know, tidbit of information and include that name. So I think, and that's how the show that I had at the age of became named, you know, the named and the unnamed, because mm-hmm. of that particular incident.
Mm-hmm. You find yourself now, I mean, do Aboriginal people and other artists come to you? Have you now assumed a role model, and that is that, if that's the case, does that cause any degree of nervousness that now you're sort of the spokesperson for a culture?
No, I think it happened to me early on. It happened to me in the late 80s when I first, you know, came in into mm-hmm. you know the scene in this country. Because at that time, you know, if you recall, like the 80s was the whole issue of appropriation was raging in this country, like who has the right to speak about who, whom, mm-hmm. or whoever, and...
in whatever way you want, grammatically or in...
Sorry, whatever, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
And at that time as well, there was this whole kind of movement of New Age, you know, craziness, madness. And so then, you know, people really looked at me at that point and were, you know, scrutinized me fairly closely and wanted me to be become the spokesperson. And so that's how I think, you know, I really gravitated towards performance at that time, because at least, you know, I had control of this thing, me. And no one mm-hmm. could take my voice away from me. So I think that's, you know, basically how I kind of have developed as an artist, mm-hmm. was it was, you know, within the art world, you know, I had to politically situate myself in order to protect myself and maintain my autonomy mm-hmm. and not to be co-opted and sold to the next tourist.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, you didn't talk about the kind of persona you developed, the high-tech teepee.
Trauma Mama,
which was,
yeah.
It was kind of famous in Toronto, certainly.
Yeah. The high-tech TV Trauma Mama was a persona that
I had to say too, you know.
Was born in Uppsala, Ontario, and she came to the city and she went into the art world and did her thing. And basically, you know, it was a persona that I used, and you know, I self-named myself the high-tech TV Trauma Mama, and I would joke that it was my Indian name and tell people this and tell the elders.
You told the elders?
I'm just joking.
Boy.
I'm joking.
Yeah.
But so I think, you know, Trauma Mama was, you know, a vehicle for me to drive around in, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, when I needed to protect myself from, you know, whatever I was paranoid about. So I think that now Trauma Mama, you know, she went to sleep
yeah.
in 1992. When Columbus was being celebrated.
Now, does that mean you don't have to protect yourself as much, or that?
No, I think I, you know, I used her when I needed her, and now she's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That seems fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this question of you, I mean, since you were, I mean, you answered my question by saying you already had been someone that represented
yes.
Aboriginal artist, whatever that term may mean. So does that mean that you have a different disposition towards the way you're viewed inside the Aboriginal community as well as inside the art community? And that there's some kind of, I don't want to talk about maturation yeah. or anything, but what happens then when you start at such a young age being recognized mm-hmm. and have to both situate yourself and are being situated by the mm-hmm. community itself? Mm-hmm. And now here you are 15 years later, mm-hmm. still doing the gigs and in fact doing, you know, the biggest gig in Canada mm-hmm. is Venice.
I think... you know, in terms of like role model, that always makes me nervous. But I think, you know, I try to be, you know, as generous as I can be and give as much time as I can, you know, where I think it's, you know, might have some worth within, particularly like within the Aboriginal community. And at the same time, I think that, you know, as I have developed my work and my way of working, I think the best thing that I can do is just to do the work. And mm-hmm. so I think I try not to become too distracted by, you know, this feeling or the pressure of, you know, responsibility to you know, represent something, both within and outside.
Does Venice change things in any way, Rebecca? I mean, it is the pinnacle inside the Canadian art world.
Yeah.
So has that made a difference to your life?
No.
Not a damn thing. They don't give you a free coffee on Air Canada, or you don't get biscuits or anything like that.
I think it's too soon to tell. Mm-hmm. You know, when I came back from Venice, I got very kind of, you know, it's like you spend a whole year of your energy, you know, building this situation, and then making the work, and then when it's over, you know, you just go home. So it's kind of like, I felt kind of, you know, maybe I had a bit of a period of where I was down in the dumps and wondering, well, what the hell was that all about? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we'll see. I think it's too soon to tell, but, you know, I have two more biennales to go to, so maybe that's
now
good.
Which one? You just did the Albanian Biennale,
yeah.
Which in a basement somewhere, which sounded great, by the way.
Well, I went to the, what he's talking about is I went to the Tirana Biennale in November. So the Venice thing happened in July, June.
The Venissage, yeah.
Anyways, in the summertime. And in November, I was invited to attend and put a piece into the Tirana Biennale in Albania. And it was basically a 180-degree turn from Venice, because Venice, you know, the budget that we had to work with was $700,000. And when I went to Albania, well, they had no money.
The budget was the money.
They didn't pay.
Your airfare was what you paid for. That was,
yeah,
the budget,
basically. Yeah. And I paid for my own hotel. And so I went. But I did it because I wanted the extreme contrast, because I wanted to come back to Earth, you know, because Venice is such a weird, you saw all those people, the cell phones, and, you know, there's so much wealth there that it's kind of freaky for an artist who, you know, struggles to make a living. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's the contradictions and all the, you know, Venice is great. It's great to be there. I'm happy that I was there. It's a great learning experience. But at the same time, I think it has its own contradictions and can make, you know, one feel a little sick afterwards. So I think, you know, it's great. It's, you know, it's supposedly what artists should dream about in terms of achievement in this country. And at the same time, you know, it's not all that it's cracked up to be. You know, it can be, it's good and bad.
And finally, you said, what other Biennale? I mean, what are you doing now?
Oh, I'm going to the Sydney Biennale in June. So I'm making a new piece for that.
And is it photo-based work you've returned to, sort of?
No, I'm returned to what I'm going to create for that, for the Sydney Biennale, is a sculpture. So I'm going back to materials, and there's no me involved beyond the making of the work. So it's non-performance. But at the same time, there is a suggestive, you know, the work suggests performance, because it's animated, it moves slightly, and I use hair, so the body is still implied. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I'm really obsessed with this hair thing at the moment.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, it's not one of my obsessions, you might have noticed. You start out by putting a question mark on the board. It seems to be, it wasn't just a casual gesture. Is the whole project of making art finally about not coming up with answers, but continuing to pose questions? I mean, I know that's something of a cliche, but have you come up with answers through the work you've done?
No. I just try to make something that's beautiful. I try to address the ugliness, and I try to hopefully, my hope is that I raise questions.
Why does the beauty matter?
Because I think that, you know, I think we as human beings love beauty. We try to make beauty. And I think, you know, as human beings, we have trouble with recognizing beauty. And by that I mean the beauty of life, of being alive, of being. And so I think, you know, for me, performance makes sense because I'm alive. I have this, you know, history. I have this, I am this person. And I think, you know, to create beauty is, you know, it makes me feel better about being here.
What do you feel like when you come out of the event of performance? I was interested in watching you look at look at these things. You sort of went back there looking at them.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to speak to audiences, and I do it a lot. It's part of my bread and butter. So I do this show thing.
I think
it's like to look at my work over and over again is interesting because I don't remember making the pieces often. Like I kind of remember Havana, like that's 1991, but then at the same time I don't really remember. So it gets, you know, it becomes like I have a weird relationship with looking at myself on tape. And the Venice Biennale piece is the second time I've used, only the second time I've used myself, you know, videotaped doing something, you know, creating an action.
You had videotape, wasn't it? I mean, normally you're in the moment. This one you actually,
yeah.
you went into that frozen water four times.
Yes. So, you know, I think it's what do I want to say? I want to say that, you know, when I create a performance and what I'm making, when I'm in the, because I think you kind of asked that question, but I went somewhere else. But when I'm in a performance, what I get out of it, you know, what I get out of it is I get the enjoyment of the making, mm-hmm. The enjoyment of being an artist, and the enjoyment of using materials and creating something. And what I've come to think, or how I've come to think about the process of making performances, is I think, well, if it looks good from my point of view, then it should look good from your point of view. So I think that's, you know, so then I think it's very much like making a sculpture, like making a painting, like making an installation, like making a video. It's you're making visual image. Mm-hmm. So
it's interesting. You must be able to cast yourself outside of it because the notion of perspective mm-hmm. is the ability to see something from a vantage point where you actually can see it. Mm-hmm. When you're inside an event, you actually have no perspective. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how you judge something as simple as the duration of a piece, because duration is the great bugaboo of performance.
Absolutely. It's essential to understand.
Yeah. So how do you make those determinations inside the event?
I can, it's kind of like, I can tell kind of like how, like feeling people's energy, and you know, that sounds kind of goofy, but it is goofy. But I can kind of sense, you know, it's really about being extremely aware and being extremely immersed and focused and to have the ability to, you know, occupy the space, control it, and do the thing that you need to do. So I think it's, you know, I think I have a fairly good sense of mm-hmm. timing and what people are willing to take. How far can I push something, you know? How much more time do I have? So I'm, you know, I do that constantly. I'm constantly thinking about mm-hmm. that when I'm making something,
you said
making a performance.
You described yourself as a crazy woman who can push it as far as you want. You're still a crazy woman, or you just understand?
When did I say that about myself?
I don't know. You said it. It's a direct quote. You know, I can pull it out if you like.
Okay. I'd like to see
Well, I got it written down here. I'm a crazy woman, and I can... if it's written, it's true.
I think
you
someone
know.
Misquoted me. I never said that.
But I also have a good sense of duration. I think probably we've spoken for our allotted time, and I want to invite you to come upstairs to the bistro where Rebecca and I will be hanging out, and we'll be delighted to answer your questions. I want to thank you very much for being such an attentive audience, and thank Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you.